Thank you very much. Well, actually, in a change to the advertised programme, I'm actually going to talk about whether government is sustainable, because I think it is kind of a more entertaining topic. But I will start by giving you some background as to why I'm going to talk about whether government is sustainable or not, which is that for the past 20 years or so, I've been tackling that question in one way, shape, or form. And I started in 1991. I wrote my undergraduate thesis on the cost of carbon control. And at that time, I was really quite concerned about the environment. And, you know, I still feel concerned about the environment. But my concern was heightened by the times that we were living in. 91, it was the year before the Rio Convention, when there was a lot of discussion about the dangers of our actions towards the environment. The Green parties were becoming more and more powerful in Europe. And I felt, you know, this is the area to get into. It didn't pass my mind that the girls who were involved in environmental concerns were also kind of hot. But, you know, I could see that this was the wave of the future. So I got very, very involved in it and wrote numerous papers and so on. And over the course of the past 20 years, have tried to develop some arguments about how we should think about climate change, energy production, our impacts on the environment more generally. And so this is a PowerPoint presentation which I produced with that in mind, to try and talk about kind of what the underlying institutions are that might bring us to a better place with regard to protecting the environment. So I'm going to quickly talk about what the meaning of sustainable development. This is a concept that's now more than 20 years old and still is bandied around quite a lot, increasingly, of course, now that we have a government in power here and a government in Britain, both of which are kind of in favour of environmental protection, in whatever that might mean. I'm going to talk about the development of economic growth and the impact on human welfare. I'm going to talk about this idea of the Kuznets curve. I'll explain that. And then I'm going to talk about some examples of unsustainable development. It's useful to contextualise the idea of sustainable development by seeing examples of where it's gone wrong. So here we go. Well, sustainable development was defined in the Brundtland Report, it's the World Commission on Environment Development, in 1997, as development that meets the needs of the present generation without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. I mean, what can you say? difficult to disagree with that, right? So the problem is actually operationalizing it. And I came to the conclusion that we can agree with the definition in general, but we should look at how, in fact, we might bring it about through seeing it as a process rather than as an outcome. For the most part, the proponents of sustainable development say that, you know, we've got this defined outcome: preventing global warming, killing the humanity in 2100, or more narrowly, trying to reduce some impact on a specific species in a particular place. Well, I think we have to look at more how people engage in economic activities and what rules you can put in place that incentivize that economic action to be beneficial, mutually beneficial, without doing as much harm to the environment. So that took me to look at the role of property rights. I did some work looking at the issue of desertification, which was a very popular idea in the 1970s. And there was the first UN Convention on Environment and Development in 1972. It was one of the big themes, desertification. And someone said that the Sahara was expanding northwards and was going to destroy North Africa. Turns out that it's not really expanding northwards or southwards. But there is a problem with land degradation, and the problem of land degradation results from the fact that people don't have the right incentives to use their land well, and so they degrade it. So the question is, well, why is land in some places used well and not in others? And it turns out that property rights are the key. If you define property rights well, enable people to own and exchange property, then they have incentives to use that property
in ways that, that benefits them. So they will conserve, so they will invest in improving that land rather than harming it. And it also enables people to use property as collateral from loans So you can get a lower cost loan, which enables you to invest in a business proposition, which may or may not lead to improvements in productivity, which leads to economic growth. The other thing that's really important is the rule of law. In countries that have the rule of law, people are able to engage in business transactions, knowing that they're not going to have their property, the things that they produce, arbitrarily expropriated by government. In places without the rule of law, in places where governments can simply step in willy-nilly, arbitrarily, then people are less willing to invest in business activities because they're concerned about the possibility that their the products will be stolen from them. So we can see examples of entrepreneurs being motivated by a desire to improve their lot, to developing technologies that benefit all of us. So I've given three examples here. The transistor, which is invented by Bell Labs, which replaced the cumbersome, inefficient valves, enabling mass production of electronic, high-tech electronic products. I thought these examples were kind of useful in a giving a talk in California, where many of these things were invented. The integrated circuit, invented by Jack Kilby at Texas Instruments, Texas there too, and enabled mass production of personal computers, leading to the automation of many tasks. Low-loss fiber optic cable, developed by Corning, revolutionized high-speed telecoms, enabling the development of the internet. So why do I give these three examples? Well, because these are green technologies. They weren't developed as green technologies, though. And this is important. You know, no government official, no Barack Obama started a program in the 1920s saying, we've got to develop some green technologies. Let's invest in green jobs. And I'm going to invest in the transistor, the integrated circuit, and low-loss fiber optic cable. Yeah, that's going to be the solution. No, this is not how innovation takes place. Right? Innovation occurs often through all sorts of mechanisms which rely on tacit knowledge of the local circumstances. It relies on insights occurring that have nothing to do with a central directed program. But because of these three technologies, which were invented independently and without a view towards developing some kind of low carbon green technology, we are able to move ideas in the form of and instantiations of ideas, music, data, and so on, across millions of miles at very high speeds and low cost, without burning nearly as much fossil fuels as we would have done previously. So they are green technologies, maybe the ultimate green technology. More generally, the incentives to innovate and develop new technologies for the benefit for profit, basically, leads to all sorts of innovations that are highly beneficial. We've got Harry Teasley sitting in the audience, so you may or may not know the expression "coals to Newcastle," when Harry was at Coca-Cola, he did a lot to lightweight the cans that Coca-Cola produced, and I'm sure he's talked to you about it. But drink cans now contain much less than half the metal that they contained in the 1970s as a result of innovations that sought to improve profits. That it was simply done to reduce the amount of material going into the can and the cost of transporting the cans from place to place. Cars are now cheaper, lighter, safer and faster and less polluting than they were 10 or 20 years ago. And I give these two examples of lightweighting also to reflect on the work that Lynn Scarlett did when she was at Reason Foundation. I mean, I think she did an enormous amount to communicate the importance of allowing innovation to take place in a decentralized private environment, because that led to these sorts of lightweighting innovations that are so beneficial for society. And I think that's the kind of program that we want to continue with at Reason. Well, there are other innovations that have been enormously important in terms of increasing productivity and reducing costs. Pesticides, fertilizers, and so on have massively increased agricultural productivity. And these have led to economic growth. And basically, the improvements in factor productivity and the development of goods that better goods at lower costs that people want to buy results in the surplus that we and continued generation of capital that we call economic growth. So we can see that before widespread private property and the rule of law, the world was a poor place. It was poor. This Angus Maddison put together this data. So for until about 1500, we're talking about $100 per capita per year, GDP. It was you know, Hobbes's description of it, nasty, brutish, and so on, was true and short. People lived people didn't live 80 years. And then from 1500 onwards, in Europe especially, things started to get better as security of property was improved. And then after 1800, literally exploded. So you've had this just rapid expansion of economic activity as the idea of private property has spread more widely around the world, and people have been able to engage in more economically productive activities. And you see from 1820 till today, the proportion of people living on a dollar a day in the world has fallen dramatically. I'm sorry, I haven't updated this to in the last 5 years with new data, but it carries on falling for the most part. And you can see that poverty, although it rose, because population rose dramatically over that period as well, it's been falling for about the past 30 years now. And I think also significantly, more rapid economic growth leads to more rapid more rapid reduction in poverty. There are those who claim that there's harms from economic growth. It is somehow some people are made more poor by economic growth. Well, no, it's the opposite. If you grow faster, the number of people who come out of poverty falls faster. Here you have a graph showing life expectancy at birth and GNI, gross national income per capita. Now this, I think, fairly clearly shows that it's better to be wealthy. It's better to be wealthy. So you do want to have those institutions that enable you to generate wealth. And this is one of the reasons why it's better to be wealthy, because if you're wealthy, then you have access to clean drinking water. And it's the dirty drinking water, which is a particularly heinous threat to health throughout the world. But nutrition is also important. And here you've seen, this is the consequence of those improvements in agricultural technology, crops, fertilizer, pesticide, and so on, rapidly rising access to nutrition throughout the world. Even in Africa, it's seen, although it's still, it's benefited less than any other area. And you've seen improvements in environmental quality. This is actually an old graph, but you can see how many of the worst pollutants have fallen dramatically. One of the interesting things is how they fell considerably in the 1960s. So this was before the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency. A lot of this is driven by improvements in efficiency. Some is driven by regulations. I'm not going to say that regulations are all bad, but a lot of it was improved. Driven by improvements in efficiency. And so this led to some work suggesting that there was an environmental Kuznets curve. So Simon Kuznets wrote about other things, but a bunch of analysts showed that in the initial stages of economic development, typically you have relatively low levels of economic growth, but low levels of environmental impact. as you as growth as economic output increases, so environmental impact increases. But then you come to a turning point, and after that turning point, as growth increases, the environment improves. And this is some work by Bruce Yandell, who presented at Reason Weekend last year. He didn't give this work, which I think is very interesting. He showed that these are the levels at which you get the environmental Kuznets curve turning point for different chemicals, different pollutants. And so you see that the ones which are eliminated first, or which decline first, are nitrates in water and other waterborne bacteria. So, for example, total coliform is the third one from the bottom. That begins to decline at about $5,000 per capita. So that's where you see economic growth having significant benefits in terms of reducing water pollution. As you go higher up, the turning point goes higher. But interestingly, at the top, you have carbon dioxide. And there's some suggestion then that you have a turning point for carbon dioxide production at somewhere between $37,000 and $57,000 per capita. Now, if that's true, then the solution to global warming, if carbon dioxide is a significant problem and cause of global warming, is rapid economic growth. Because we'll then be able to afford to reduce carbon dioxide emissions or maybe develop the technologies that enable us to do so more effectively. And of course, you don't have to have the same levels of wealth in every country to adopt the technologies. So here we've got the changes. Sorry, I'll go back to the first slide. This is electricity consumption in 1971 against wealth. So electricity consumption on the vertical axis and wealth on the horizontal axis. And you can see, I should have done a Hans Rosling type slide with sort of wonderful bubbles growing out, but didn't have time. So you can see relatively low levels of electricity consumption at all levels of wealth, but obviously wealthier people have more access to electricity. As time goes on, you can see electricity consumption increasing in many countries, but even at relatively low levels of wealth. And you can see some of these, right at the left-hand side, you can see relatively less wealthy people having increasing amounts of electricity, but of course, that's not to say that you don't want to have more wealth, because that you get more electricity consumption, and that's a good thing. You can have air conditioning, you can have heating, you can prevent lots of nasty things from happening, and live much happier, healthier lives. But one of the consequences of increasing electricity consumption is to reduce the burning of coal and other things that produce nasty indoor pollution. So here's a graph of the types of energy consumed by people in homes in China. And you can see that until the early 1980s, coal was the dominant source of heating for the home in China. Dramatically so. And over time, that's gradually been replaced by electricity. So coal is in pale blue, and electricity is the maroon color above that. So the increasing access to electricity has had a huge impact on what fuels people consume at home, and this has impacts for particulate pollution. So here you have particulate pollution in India and China between 1990 and 2002. You can see a fairly substantial decline, and it's continued declining for the most part. And that's in large measure, in both cases, a result of increasing access to alternative forms of energy, especially electricity. And that's been enabled by the low-cost transfer of technologies which were developed in rich countries. And the same is true in many respects for improvements in child mortality rates in poorer countries. Over a period of 40 years, you have dramatic declines in child mortality rates as vaccines and other technologies, rehydration therapy, is transferred from the West to wealthy countries. But a combination of wealth and technology transfer has also had substantial impacts on one of the problems that's supposedly related to climate change. So here you have deaths from or death rates from extreme weather events from the 1920s until the last decade, and you can see that as wealth has risen on the red line, death rates from weather related natural disasters has fallen precipitously. I mean, it's just tiny, barely measurable compared to the situation 100 years ago. So this leads to a sort of a revised environmental Kuznets curve. So what's being explained here is that actually you have problems when wealth is low, but also when you don't have access to technologies. As access to technology improves, then the impact on the environment improves more quickly. But I also want to give you some examples of unsustainable development, if I've got some time. So here's, I took a trip in 2002 to from Delhi to Agra. So Agra is where the Taj Mahal is. And to go there, we went past this, at the border between Delhi and Uttar Pradesh, we went past a queue of trucks that I think must have been 2 or 3 miles long. And I stopped at the end of the when we stopped at the end of the queue to transition into Uttar Pradesh, I turned to the driver and I said, what are all these trucks doing? I said, this looks like sustainable transport. They're not moving, so that's clearly sustainable. And he said, oh, silly Brit. Pointed out that there was a little kiosk nearby where the truck drivers were getting a what's called a chit. Then they were paying their 50 rupees to get their chit, and then they could pass through. But that process takes time. You've got bureaucrats involved in it, and so they the trucks just sit there for hours. Some of these trucks were transporting perishable goods. Now, not many of them are refrigerated, so. This is a wonderful contributor to which is a major problem throughout the developing world, especially, which is how food just wastes between the farmer and the consumer. This is a classic reason for it. Here's an example of unsustainable development, though. So, from the 30s onwards, the Soviets attempted to increase output. Basically by increasing inputs. I mean, so we all know that if you put more into a sausage machine, you'll get more sausages out. And that was the basic premise of Soviet productivity. And so you did get a rise in output to some extent. But the problem is that they didn't have the right signals to drive efficiency improvements. They would use Sears catalogs to identify what prices were, and they would steal technologies from the West, or even occasionally buy them. The Fiat 125, I think it was one, became the dominant car in the entire Soviet Union. But the trouble is that in attempting to sort of enforce this system, they had to instigate the most horrendous political controls. And at the end of the day, they also destroyed the environment. So in the area around the Aral Sea, there were several rivers going into the Aral Sea, and these were diverted for the production of cotton. And by so doing, they caused real desertification. And here's an example of unsustainable development in India. This little object is what's called a gas regulator. You have to install it on your little natural gas canister in order to enable gas to go into your cooker. And at least until recently, the Delhi government had a monopoly on these on the supply of these regulators, and you would have to pay the equivalent of $60 to buy this regulator. Now, that's actually a regulator made in China that you can buy for about 50 cents. So the Delhi government was taking this massive amount of money. As a result, a large proportion of people in Delhi were still, 10 years ago, burning wood and dung, especially wood. I mean, wood was a dominant source of energy in the peripheral area of Delhi. Central Delhi, people had electricity, they had gas and so on, but on the periphery, they were burning a lot of wood, and it was contributing to a major amount of pollution. And this, again, these photos from these are just outside the Taj Mahal in Agra, a village that really would be recognizable to people who are experts on medieval European history, I think. The consequence of this is that people burn, something like 70% of the Indian population still gets the majority of its heat from burning wood and dung, with horrible consequences. So here's a graph of air pollution impacts around the world. Right at the bottom, you can see outdoor air pollution. I included that for comparison. These are World Health Organization figures, and I don't trust the outdoor air figures very, very much because I know what they're based upon. But the indoor figures, I think, are probably not bad. They tell a really depressing story. Acute lower respiratory infections and chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder account for about 1.5 million deaths a year. And if you think of it in terms of life years lost, it's much worse because of the fact that so many of these are children and women, relatively young women, who live indoors and are cooking the meal indoors and getting subjected to this noxious pollution. So this is unsustainable development for sure. So the lessons are, don't try to plan centrally. I think that's pretty clear. Enable private ownership, enable people to trade freely, both locally and internationally, and prohibit arbitrary discretionary actions of government officials. Now, I think that we now need to think about applying these rules back here in the United States. And so one of the things we're going to do at Reason Foundation is develop a more ambitious program on environmental issues, especially focusing on what the real benefits what the real measures are that will lead to beneficial environmental actions domestically, and question some of the dubious interventions which are being rolled out now. For example, restrictions on all sorts of technologies that are hugely beneficial, whether they're agricultural technologies or indeed electricity generating technologies. Thank you very much.